Hello there, everyone, and welcome to a special bonus episode of the Horn Call Podcast. My name is James Bolden. I'm the publications editor for the International Horn Society, and I'm actually not the host of this episode. I'm really excited to share the result of a collaboration between Mike Harcrow, who is the editor of Horn & More, the digital newsletter that so many of you subscribe to, and the editor of the pedagogy column, Professor Dan Grabois, who's the professor of horn at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We started talking a while ago about ways to sort of distribute content across different platforms and different ways of getting it to fans of the IHS. And Dan was gracious enough to share with me an interview that he did as part of his pedagogy column in Horn & More with Richard King, the well-known he's now playing fourth horn with the Cleveland Orchestra, but for many, many years was the solo horn, principal horn with the Cleveland Orchestra. And there's just a wealth of knowledge in this interview with him. And I want to thank Mike and Dan and, of course, Richard King for sharing their knowledge and their talents on this episode.
I'm Dan Grabois with another recorded interview for the pedagogy column, this time with horn player Richard King. Rich, hello.
How are you doing, Dan?
I'm good. Thank you so much for doing this.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to see you.
You are currently playing fourth horn with the Cleveland Orchestra, having played principal horn for a large number of years. Tell us how many years, first of all, did you play principal horn?
I think officially, by myself, I played principal for 18 years.
Wow.
Before that, I was acting principal in a co-principal role. And then before that, I was 7 years associate principal. And I've been playing fourth horn for 8 years. And this is the beginning of my 36th season.
You know the orchestra inside and out.
I do. I know this one inside and out. Yeah.
I think probably a lot of people who were watching this would be interested in your audition experience for the orchestra, because a lot of people out there want to win an audition. You've done it a few times.
My first audition for the Cleveland Orchestra, back in the day, for associate principal, there was no screen at all. And what makes Cleveland still different, although there's a screen now for the entire process, that's a new addition to our contract. One of the things that made Cleveland unique, for better or for worse, was that the music director hears everybody from the beginning. And it's been a little more regimented over the years as far as voting and stuff like that. But when I went to audition first, I was 20 years old, and my predecessor in the associate principal role, Eric Rusk, had retired at 24 years old. He played 4 years. And he was leaving the Cleveland Orchestra. So I was a student at Curtis, and one of my friends said, well, why not? You're 20. He was 20. And I said, okay, why not? And so I sent my resume in, which said, you know, French horn, you know, the Curtis Institute of Music Orchestra on it. I mean, I didn't have much of a resume, really hardly any professional experience at all. And I was not that surprised when I got a letter back saying, thank you, but we're not going to invite you this time. They went back into the stack of resumes after there was a no hire. And I had two things that maybe caught their attention. One was that my teacher was Myron Bloom, who had played first horn in Cleveland until about a dozen years before that. And the second thing was I had played in a master class with the violinist Joseph Gingold, who taught at Indiana and had been a concertmaster in the Cleveland Orchestra way back. But, you know, his name carried a lot of weight. I played a Brahms trio for him at a coaching or masterclass, and went up to him and said, would you please write me a recommendation? He wrote this glowing recommendation. Very nice man. So I went to audition in Cleveland, and you know, there are maybe 20 people or something like that. They don't really invite that many people. They didn't that day. And there were four finalists. And then I played some more, and the personnel manager came down to the staging area and said that there was no winner, but the music director would like to speak with me. And I was like, in my head, I was like, well, why does he want to speak with me? It was Christoph von Dohnányi, the music director at the time. And the short story is that I showed some potential, like a lot of people do when they're young. And I had absolutely no experience, doing that kind of a job. So they hired me kind of on a week-to-week basis. Playing the horn on a week-to-week basis is a little bit nerve-wracking. But I got my feet on the ground after a few months, and they'd offered me a contract for the following year. So that was some of my colleagues were really, really patient and helpful, which just made a great, it gave me a chance to learn the ropes, because I know a lot of young people, and I know that I did think that they know an awful lot. And then I got into a situation where everybody was so much more experienced and everybody knew how to play together and everything. And it was a real learning experience. The second audition I took in the Cleveland Orchestra was for principal horn when my predecessor, Rick Solis, who was principal horn there for about 20 years, stepped down. And I guess in the trade agreement, I was allowed to play in the finals only. But again, there was no screen, so there was no surprise. So I asked if I could play in the first round, hoping that first, it would be good enough to get advanced. And second of all, they probably wouldn't cut me because they know me after playing there for 7 years. And that things from that audition, some things went extremely well. Some things, there's always things that go better and go worse. But the things that I felt strongly about, I really felt like I gave it everything I had. And that it takes a lot of courage that I didn't really understand if I had to just go lay it out like that, because I knew that they expected me to really, really go for it. At that point, I was hired with another player, and we played 1 week on, 1 week off for two seasons until the music director, same guy, Christoph von Dohnányi, made a choice to hire me. So those were my two auditions in Cleveland.
And talk a little bit, if you would, about the pressures of playing first horn. I mean, I can imagine that playing, Till Eulenspiegel and four performances a week, or Bruckner four, or any of the pieces with Mahler five, it must be a lot of stress.
Yeah. We all have experiences in a conservatory or whatever of having a big show. You know, you work on it for a month or something like that, and you go and you do it once, and you're really up for it, and it goes well, and you feel good. And the thing that everybody who's not on this side of the equation, the thing that people don't understand as well is that, if you go do it Thursday, you got to do it Friday, Saturday, maybe Sunday. So if you're really pleased with how it goes, then you got to wake up and do it again the next day. If you're not so pleased with how it goes, then you usually have another opportunity really quickly. My first concert as acting principal horn, Mahler five, my first concert officially as principal horn of the Cleveland Orchestra, Concertstück. Followed in the same week by three Tills, followed the next week by four Heldenlebens. I mean, it doesn't stop. And that was the kind of stress that brought me down most, and took a long time, between vacations and stuff to sort of get rejuvenated and restructured. The day-to-day part of it, you can really get into a groove, and you learn what routines work and what sets you up the best. And I also asked a bunch of people how they felt about it. I asked my teacher, Mr. Bloom, what he did to cope with a job and a kind of a terrifying conductor in George Sell that he worked for and revered. And he said that he was as prepared as he could possibly be at all times. And that really made him feel as secure as he was going to feel. And I think that's really important, especially as a kind of rookie. It's more difficult if you're going through repertoire for the first time, for sure. But after you've seen the whole, most of the repertoire, there are so many less surprises. The surprises then become, what the conductor on the podium, what the tempos might be that week, things like that, if I have to breathe in a different place than I plan. I have a wonderful newish colleague who plays first horn in Cleveland, Nathaniel Silberschlag, and I get to hear him. I sit right behind him, and he's going through a lot of repertoire for the first time. And, you know, sometimes he turns around at the end of a show and he's like, you know, like, that's, you know, we made it. And I can only say, you know, I understand. You're doing great, and I understand how you feel. There are different stresses in different jobs in a symphony orchestra. There are different stresses in jobs outside of orchestra life. So it's just finding a groove, I guess, finding a routine that really helps you be as grounded as possible. And I think one thing that really helped me was that when I felt like I succeeded, I did really well, and I was pleased with how things are going, I never really celebrated. And when I, in order not to have the highs be too different from the lows, if I had a concert where I didn't feel like it went as well as it might have, and there certainly are those instances when you play that many concerts, I didn't let it bother me so much because I knew that I'd have another chance. Doesn't mean to say it doesn't bother you. And it doesn't, commensurately, it doesn't mean to say that when I thought I did something really special, or when I thought I was really proud of what I did, I would feel proud. I would feel happy for myself, and I would feel happy when our section played well, and when our concerts, the orchestra concerts, sounded good, you know, for all of us. It, you know, but I try to keep it as even as possible.
I think the answer to my question is going to be practicing, but here's the question.
Okay.
You've got more than that. Do you have advice for young players on how to develop the kind of consistency that's required to hold down a professional orchestra job where everybody's depending on you to get the job done day after day after day?
Well, practicing, Dan. practicing and having a regular regimen of like fitness is a really important thing to me. Practicing when you're playing a first horn job, you know, if you're really playing full tilt, as you know from your own playing experience and everybody who plays does, sometimes you don't have that much time to practice. So I used to really be happy when I had a day off, and I know students are going to hate to hear this, but you know, I would just go through Koprosh and Galley and stuff like that. I really would. Whether it was in front of a football game or the television or whatever, just to get my reps in, to get my laps in. Every time I hear a masterclass, we were talking about this a minute ago before we started recording, and you were nice enough to do a masterclass for my school in Cleveland last week. Every time I attend a masterclass, I get these great hints that not only help the person on the stage, the student playing, but, you know, help me rethink a little bit of what I'm doing as well. So there was a brilliant masterclass one time that Phil Myers did at CIM in Cleveland many years ago. And he was talking about the Farkas book and the accuracy study that's got one quarter note. Everybody knows that one quarter note on in the beginning of each 4/4 bar. And how maybe you should really read this, the chapter on accuracy and just to have a reliable strike on the notes. And I was thinking to myself, well, I'm a pretty good horn player and I've played that out of that book before. What, you know, what's a couple of paragraphs by somebody else going to teach me? And I went home and I read it and it was a real eye opener. I think the most important thing for horn players to feel comfortable and confident is knowing that you have a reasonable shot that the note is going to strike it where you think it's going to happen. And you know, that's something all horn players struggle with, you know, accuracy and consistency, things like that. So when I felt like I was, we all have days, we open the case and it's just, everything is really easy. But when I have days where it just doesn't feel quite right, I would play through that Farkas etude with a metronome on. And it takes 7 or 8 minutes. And it sort of gets me re-slotted, you know, recalibrated. We want to play, technically, we want to play as robotically as we can. We want to make sure that everything's firing properly. I have to just claim every time I say something like that, I don't mean play like a robot whatsoever. But I mean, what we do to play consistently has to do with how we strike notes. And this is no surprise to any wind player at all. It has to do with how the air gets into the horn from however you conceive of it. And we all have routines for that. And we all have, you know, shortcuts when things start to go sideways a little bit. The most consistent players, horn players, brass players that I have ever heard seem to warm up the same way every day for years and years. And although it's not that glamorous and exciting, it seems to serve people very well when they do that. And it doesn't matter where your routines come from or who suggested them to you, but you tailor them to your own experience and needs. Yeah.
Playing principal horn, of course, you're up in the high register an awful lot. Some pieces especially can really be can be high and stay high. So what advice would you have for a young player developing a high register? Not just consistency, but just even getting the notes, getting up to C, getting up above C.
Right. Well, I'll just back up a minute if I can. When I started in Cleveland, I was playing associate principal, and that is easy in a way and difficult in a way. So I get a lot of Mozart piano concertos. I get a lot of things like that. That's the job that the associate has a lot of the time. And so I got pretty good at aiming in the high register, and I never used a descant horn or anything like that during that period of my career. It seemed to me that what I needed to work on for my own playing, I left school when I was 20 years old, and I wasn't, now I realize that nobody's ever done learning how to play, but I was definitely not set to go off into the world yet in my own mind and in my teacher's mind as well. I know that. After I learned how to do the specific associate job there, and I had a great relationship with the principal, and, you know, we had a great sort of way of, you know, I knew what he was going to assign me to. I realized when I was 22 or 23 years old that I had a ceiling above me that I hadn't reached yet. And I started practicing more methodically. And as I got to play more, you know, bigger rep as a first horn player, when he would take some time off, and then, you know, after I got the job to play principal, I realized that the efficiency in the high register was absolutely paramount, because you don't want to go into a Mahler symphony and make it, you know, just into the beginning of the last movement and then, you know. So I really thought a lot about vowel sounds, and I know that people talk about vowel sounds in different language or whatever, but I got the great experience for, I don't know, 15 more years of sitting next to Eli Epstein, who played second horn in Cleveland, who is just a remarkable horn player. And I also heard him speak about playing, and I heard masterclasses that he did and things like that. And he would talk about vowel sounds. And I just, I made sure that the high register, when I was playing it, was really lined up with an E vowel sound, so that the back of your tongue or under your ears or whatever you want to say is really high, and that the same amount of air that you would blow over that, it has a very small space to go and just flies into the instrument, so that I'm always in the high register. I feel like I'm always in the right neighborhood. That has a lot to do with accuracy and confidence as well, because if you think like you're in the right spot, you feel like you can really play easily and comfortably. I remember trying to get up into the high register and then down into the low register by playing 2-octave scales and 2-octave arpeggios. And the reason that I want, I wanted myself, and I've asked my students also, to play 2 octaves is to make sure that it sounds even over a pretty broad range. Because what I noticed about my colleague and friend Eli Epstein was that he had, like, it seemed like he had a 5-octave middle register. It was just astounding. He was an incredible low horn player, but he could absolutely play up to the highest ceiling of a horn. It just seemed like effort. And that was a real inspiration to me to learn how to play easily. So a concept of vowel sounds and a concept of the flavor or the taste or whatever Mr. Farkas said about each note is really an important thing. And it's not that anybody can actually tell you exactly where that would be for you, but there's experimenting. And if you have to play something that sits at the top of the staff, it would be great if that wasn't the highest note that you could play. So you have to go above that I've heard some great recordings of you playing real high and high notes. And so we go above the staff, and that's where we have to be sure we can cover the range easily.
I'd love to dig into. Sorry, go ahead.
I hope that helps. I don't know.
It does. No, that's great. And I'd like to dig in a little bit more to the concept of vowels, because this may be new to some people. So this is something that I think about all the time in my horn playing as well. And a lot of the pedagogy that I've been exposed to through reading or master classes or whatever can be very technical about tongue placement and jaw. And the whole idea behind vowels, as I conceive of it, is that if you shape the sound E or O or U or any of these other sounds, your tongue goes to where it goes when you make that vowel. And you don't have to think, well, it needs to be 5.6 millimeters from the roof of my mouth. So I'm wondering if you can just talk about that a little bit. I mean, is this a way to free yourself from the more technical sides of thinking about the horn?
To simplify anything for someone who's trying to figure it out is the best thing that any educator can do. So I think of the sound, the shape of the inside of my mouth. And I have 4 points on the instrument, and I don't know if I can say it clearly without a horn, but a second line G, I always just say ah, and the way I ask people to say ah is if you have a sore throat and you go to the doctor and they put a tongue depressor, I don't think they do that anymore, you say ah, and that's what I do, and that's like the middle note on the horn for me. That's where I find it. An octave below that, and I'm talking horn pitch, an octave below that, the G below middle C, I'm from New York, and I just say aw, A-W, aw, like that. And I just say, well, you see a cute little puppy in the park, aw. In the Middle West, people don't say that vowel sound very easily. We say aw, like that, and then it's going to sound more like that. The low register where I'm making my living these days, like a low C, is just a big oh, you know, that's what I do. And if you say oh, then the back of your tongue it's in a certain spot. And then in the high register, definitely E. If you say E, you know, it sounds kind of silly to say that, but I mean, it shoots the air over the top of it and it'll put you in the right neighborhood. So when you hear someone who's playing really easily, even if they scrape a note or they, you know, there's some imperfection, really experienced horn players don't miss by a fifth or an octave. It's very rare that you get that like yodel, you know, that we're always accused of. So the more that you can kind of dial it in and you get a feel for how natural it is, then if you miss a note, it's going to be pretty close to the right note. So it's not going to be as much of a calamity. And of course, we have to hear the note before we play it. And sometimes that's really easy. And sometimes it's very difficult if it's, you know, atonal music or something. We do the best we can for that.
So just to absolutely state the obvious, because I think it's such an important point that you're making, and a lot of times what one hears in pedagogy is like, maintain your stability. But what we're talking about here is that stuff moves, and that's okay. Stuff moves. And even in a player who doesn't appear to be moving around from the outside, the stuff on the inside is moving.
Yeah, it really is. So I think that when I look in a mirror when I play, my jaw doesn't go up and down very much. I know that other people think of their jaw going up and down quite a lot, and that's absolutely fine. It's absolutely whatever works for anybody. But what I think of is more inside my mouth. You know, it's the airplane flaps below your ears, kind of inside. And I try to describe it in 100 different ways because there's maybe something will stick. And if you hear a horn player on the radio or on a recording or in a concert and they're playing easily and it sounds natural, I'm sure they're doing some form of this, whether they're thinking of it in these terms or not. I know there's another school of thought about playing down in the mouthpiece or blowing the air into the mouthpiece. I heard about that a few years ago and I was totally incredulous, and I tried thinking about it and it messed me up completely. And then I asked one of my colleagues and he said, oh, you're doing it, but you just don't know you're doing it. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, we all think of it in a different way. when you find the vowel sounds that work for you, then you have a voice that's got a pretty big register. And that's, as a horn player, that's what we need. When you and I were youngsters, there was much more of a divide. You can either play high horn or low horn, you know, and it was that. And now it's, if you're not a complete player, you have so much less of an option to do any kind of career in the horn, with the horn. Yes, stuff moves, Dan. It does.
Yeah. These ideas are so great. I really want to thank you for talking about all this with our audience.
Thank you for asking, and keep up the good work. Really appreciate you asking me.